Welcome to the Geopolitical Ecology Podcast, where you will find critical conversations at the intersections of nature, culture, and power.
In this episode, we sit with Philippe Le Billon and Eric Post and discuss a wide array of topics, all connected by a thread of seeing sustainable development as yet another iteration in the long history of capitalist development. By examining violence and systemic injustices, as well as counter-hegemonic resistances, we situate the projects and paradigms advertised as sustainable in a long history of colonial extraction and exploitation. Of course, as with most things, there are nuances that cannot be ignored. That is, how does sovereignty and independence fit into this picture? How do we make sense of violence that may appear to some as happening in a vacuum, but are fundamentally intertwined with global empire? How do we reconcile national development in the global south with the impacts of development on nature? These are some big questions to which critical insight is offered by our guests Philippe and Eric today. Philippe is a professor at the University of British Columbia, jointly appointed in the Department of Geography and the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs. His research interests bring together political geography, political ecology, and war studies. He has focused most of his work on the links between natural resources and armed conflicts, but has also examined the political economy of war and reconstruction, the resource curse, corruption, as well as natural disasters and political crises. His work spans multiple geographies, from Latin America to Southeast Asia to Sub-Saharan Africa, and it tackles various resources wrought from the earth, from food to fossil fuels to metals and minerals that are notoriously associated with the violence accompanying their extraction, such as cobalt in the Congo. Eric is currently in Mexico conducting fieldwork for his PhD dissertation, which he is working with Philippe on completing. Broadly, his research explores geopolitics, violence, and colonialism in Latin America, in Mexico in particular, and the decolonial futures proposed by indigenous struggles for racial, environmental, and climate justice. He examines how these conflicts are influenced by, and themselves influence, power structures, state and corporate discourses, and practices, as well as the mobilization of values, norms, and principles in the politics of sustainable development and alternative development rationalities. I am joined by my co-host, friend, and comrade, Erica, and here is our conversation with Philippe Le Billon and Eric Post.
Hello. Thank you so much, Philippe and Eric, for joining us on Geopolitical Ecology. Super excited to dig into your work. And, you know, Yusuf and I have been reading up on some of the amazing work that you've done, and honestly, like, a little overwhelmed by just how much you've both done. But I guess for the purpose of this episode, we've picked a couple of papers and projects to focus on, and just to kind of ground the conversation. But before that, do you think you could each kind of give our listeners a little bit of a history on how you ended up thinking, reading, and writing about these topics, such as extractivism, geopolitical ecology, how that relates to development and things like that, just a bit of a personal history?
Yeah, I can certainly start. This is Philippe. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining this podcast. So I came into it through logging, the forest. The forest industry. I was in Cambodia and working there with a group called Global Witness. They're kind of a human rights organization focusing on corruption and environmental damages. And I followed the campaigns and collaborated with them. And at one point, they shifted from forestry to mining, in particular diamonds. And so I got interested in diamond mining around Angola and then Sierra Leone, etc. And that led me to think a lot about mining conflicts, and I got into extractivism. That's as simple as that. So since then, I've been working mostly in Latin America, West Africa, and other places. Thank you.
Very cool. Thank you so much.
And Eric?
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this podcast. Thank you for joining us. So, yes, I'm Eric Post, and my route is also somewhat circuitous towards researching extractivisms, but goes back to when I was a teenager, really. With just only 15 years of age, I was lucky or unlucky enough to go on a cultural exchange year to the north of Mexico, which at that time was experiencing the height of the drug war that was unleashed by Calderón against the so-called cartels. And it was really a traumatizing experience in many ways as a 15-year-old to experience that high level of violence in Saltillo, Coahuila. Also traveling to Monterrey and Nuevo León, you know, I saw really terrifying things and had grenades explode in the street close to me, and at the clubs I would go to get shot up. I had people who were my neighbors get kidnapped for ransom, and all of these really, really, really horrific experiences, which led me to think about where this violence would come from, you know, and really made me want to understand what could unleash such violence onto the world, and to, you know, do something to make the world a little bit more peaceful, which back then in my naivete, I thought the best way to do that would be to join the diplomatic corps and work as a diplomat and, you know, bring about world peace and yada yada. But entering the Dutch Foreign Service as an intern, I was slotted into the Great Lakes Task Force, the Sub-Saharan African Great Lakes Region Task Force, and working in the direction of the Directorate of Stabilization and Humanitarian Aid, which led me to study the conflicts in the DRC, you know, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, in quite some depth. And obviously the role of natural resources there is crucial, right? As Philippe will probably later on further clarify. But this led me down the path of, yeah, looking at that intersection of natural resource extraction and how this intersects with armed conflict. And that has been the thread throughout my career ever since, both professionally and academically.
Wow, thank you so much for sharing that. It does sound like quite the experience for a 15-year-old, for sure. And like, really interesting to see that your kind of lived experience as a teenager has informed so much of your career and work. And also like great sneak peek into some of the topics we'll be covering, some of your work in Mexico, as well as Philippe's work in the DRC. But before that, I think we have some kind of theoretical framing questions that we have for you. So Yusuf, do you want to jump into that part?
Definitely. I had the privilege to read something you shared with me, Eric, which is a paper that you're co-authoring and working on publishing right now. The title is The Green War, Geopolitical Metabolism and Green Extractivisms. And I was wondering to start if you could both provide us and our listeners with a brief overview of the paper, the concepts you're engaging with, as in what do you mean by green war, geopolitical metabolism, and green extractivism, and if you could share some of the arguments you're making in the paper. Philippe, maybe you can start.
Yeah, so the idea of the green war was really to say, well, there's this intense geopolitical competition at the moment in many, many domains, one of which is around the idea of climate mitigation and the great transition. So, you know, it can be done benevolently, thinking, yes, we need to abate, you know, reduce those emissions. Electrification is the way to go for it. Of course, you know, economies need to continue growing, supposedly. So why don't we do that through technologies that require lots of resources? And so on the ground, what's happening is a lot of contentions around those resources. By looking at the geopolitical lens, we are really trying to understand, is there an opposition between those groups and a lot of mimicking in a way? So the Green War, the concept itself, the term has been used in many different ways. But here we're using the idea of, kind of the Cold War being replaced by this kind of Green War. Of course, it's not being replaced. It's just one more dimension of international competition, okay? And that's often superficial because when you look at the details of the projects on the ground, very often there's a lot of corporations, and the victims of the Green Wars are often people on the ground, the communities, etc., if they're not able to harness the potentialities of these extractive projects. So that's a bit the idea behind the Green War, but I'll let Eric provide some more explanations on this.
Yeah, thanks, Philippe, for setting it up so brilliantly. I think indeed what we tried to argue in the piece, said simply and straightforwardly, is that there's this intention to advance and consolidate imperial power, you know, in the name of mitigating climate change and mitigating the biodiversity crisis, or what we would call, you know, this frame of planetary security, you know, and that this often works as a foil to advance national and regional strategic interests rather than to actually mitigate climate change or to combat, you know, the loss of biodiversity in the world. And at the same time, we see a basically intensification of the extractivist projects that have underpinned, you know, the modern colonial capitalist world system ever since. And this is very clearly seen when you look at the rate of the extraction of materials and energy in the world. That's a graph that just keeps going up, 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 and up, right? Regardless of the rhetoric that accompanies this green war framing. And maybe what is important to stress is that we do see a qualitative break between the Green War era and previous eras. And that break with the past is that natures have always been, you know, intrinsic to imperial politics and violence, but at then the in the current era and with the current framing, they're really part of this broader agenda of planetary security, which we think reconfigures the geopolitical metabolism, right? And geopolitical metabolism is another concept that we try to explore and define in this paper, because we think it's very useful as a heuristic and as an analytical frame for geopolitical ecology, pointing at what we would call like the co-constitutive set of material processes and geopolitical frames that seek to, you know, both maintain and or challenge, right, a political and economic order. So here we understand geopolitical metabolism as like a geopolitically oriented approach to social metabolism, which is a concept that is quite well known and used broadly in academia, right? To analyze capitalist production and how this requires the appropriation of energy and material flows and ecological services, right? But by really highlighting this geopolitical angle, we seek to capture how the geopolitics of this, much more than just the capitalist appropriation of natures, there's also a geopolitical appropriation of natures and how this dialectically intertwines, right, with natures and how they shape one another, put simply. So that's kind of the idea. And where we think geopolitical metabolism as a concept is useful is in that it allows you to neatly, in a way that sums up kind of the ways that energy and material flows are used to maintain and or challenge these economic and political orders. So we can see how previously in let's say the late 19th century, the geopolitical metabolism was really focused on securing and restricting the flow of fossil fuels, right? Whereas in the emergent configuration, we see it emphasize critical materials, low carbon technologies, climate change mitigation projects, without saying that there's no fossil fuel dimensions anymore involved. It's just, it allows you to look at those permutations and those rearticulations. So we're not trying to say that this is absolutely new. Rather, there are deep historical roots to what's happening. But there are some interesting transformations of those processes. And we think these two concepts help us to clearly identify that and put it in a sort of summed up manner, right?
Yeah, wonderful, brilliant. I think one thing I really enjoyed while reading this paper is how, as you said, it provides a framework and the sense of trying to wrap our heads around shifting power dynamics on this grand international system, kind of world system scale, but also keeping in mind always that there's an underground reality that includes and involves ecologies and communities that are often left out of the this big picture discourse of this massive transition, right, to a post-carbon future. And one thing I really enjoyed when reading this was discussing the hegemonic crisis that we are witnessing in terms of the China's ascent, essentially. And I've been following quite closely the discourses around critical minerals and securing the supply chains for critical minerals. So, for instance, I was looking at Canada's critical minerals strategy, and I think the number of times that they mention, you know, national security is mind-blowing. I mean, I don't know the exact number, but it's pretty frequent. And I can imagine that maybe there was a period in time where these discourses around the green transition weren't so heavy on national security and so on. I think this is a bit of a preface to say that I notice a bit of a pattern of weaponizing the green transition by states and corporations to justify extractive activities. In terms of maintaining hegemony, I think that's maybe we can talk about that, but it's a little bit, for me at least, easier to wrap my head around than when I think of a global South nation, such as, say, Bolivia, very rich in lithium, and it's seeking to develop its lithium as a way that is crucial to its own development, for instance, when it comes to the alleviation of poverty, let's say. I wanted to ask you how we can wrap our heads around decarbonization in this form in the context of economic growth. Like, how can we expect a nation state such as Bolivia, that has this colonial history and present, to develop without exploiting its nature in an extractivist fashion? I know it's a big question, but I feel like you both have a lot to say about it.
Well, obviously, it's an important question, especially for Bolivia and Ecuador. As you know, both countries, have been on the left for quite a long time, and both have had important resources. Ecuador with oil, in particular, and Bolivia with lithium. What has happened with Bolivia is that it took a very strong neo-extractivist stand, by which I mean they really wanted to develop lithium and exploit it. Outside the frame of empire, in a way, with the idea that they would stay in control of it, they would establish a national company, etc. And as a result, unfortunately, there's been a lot of delays in setting that up because they were not backed in many ways. They were outcompeted. The market was not that mature, and so exploitation of lithium mining has been kind of delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed in the country. And we've seen that also a little bit in Ecuador, where there was this attempt to, delay the exploitation or prevent the exploitation of fossil fuels, and in particular oil, in the Yasuni National Parks. So in both cases, there's been attempt to look at alternatives. And what we saw generally in the end, unfortunately again, was that they had to ally with capital, and so now extractivists took on more of a kind of classic extractivist. So unfortunately, within the context of decarbonization that is very resource intensive, we're still falling back on those same kinds of patterns. Okay. And for me, that's really a pity, in particular for the local communities, which felt very impacted, of course. And also it shows the limits of the relative agency of those states when they're trying to, follow a different path. And so there it, we can talk about degrowth because that's also some of the values that were associated with both countries. That Ecuador passed a constitution recognizing, non-human rights and the rights of nature, etc. But again, in practice, it's been very difficult to push for and to resist extractive projects through this. Same thing a little bit for Bolivia with, a number of indigenous Quechua-based values, nature-centered values, etc. Yeah.
Right, like incorporating buen vivir in the constitution, for instance. Yeah,
Exactly. Yeah.
yeah. Eric, you wanted to say something?
Well, maybe just to add that indeed, like you had these very promising developments around the concepts of buenos vivires or good livings, which were rooted in alternative epistemologies and ontologies, particularly in indigenous thought, that truly do offer in many ways an alternative to this capital intensive, natural resource dependent development, and that were in many ways co-opted by state actors. And what we've seen is that after reaching power and having to make these alliances with capital and being once again slotted in this subordinate position that is in many ways reminiscent of the previous colonial and neo-colonial extractivist models that these countries were trapped in, there has actually been a strong repression of the base of where these alternative ideas of buenos vivires originated from. And many of the social movements, right, that were part of the road or the pathway to power that both in Ecuador and Bolivia, the left-wing or pink tide governments enjoyed, have been in that sense very much reneged on and felt, in a sense, treason, right? From their from once reaching power, they felt stabbed in the back and left behind and actually repressed. And we see very similar things here in Mexico, just to add from my personal experience. Right here, we've had AMLO coming to power, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, in 2018, promising a fourth transformation in the trotting in the footsteps of the Mexican Revolution and the nationalization of the oil sector, and like really promising this like massive change of how the country's been run, ending with neoliberalism and the dispossession, right, of indigenous and peasant communities. He enjoyed tremendous popular support, particularly from social movements that are truly rooted in territorial defense and rural life, livelihoods and modes of living. But when reaching power, basically what did AMLO do? He doubled down on Mexico's oil production and petrochemical profile and the hydrocarbon dependency of its economy, using the language of energy sovereignty and energy security to buttress this whole state-owned apparatus of energy extraction and generation, while at the same time nationalizing the lithium deposits in Mexico, calling them, creating a new state-owned company, Litiomex, that supposedly will serve to deliver well-being to all Mexicans. But behind the scenes, what we see is there's a very deep continued dependence on U.S. natural gas extraction, pipelines that are being constructed in collaboration with Canadian companies like TC Energy, but also U.S. companies. The Litiomex company that's state-owned is basically just a front office behind which there's still Chinese and U.S. Capital interests working to actually get those lithium deposits towards being exploited. So there's a lot of resource nationalism and narratives about sovereignty and independence and anti-imperialist politics, but these tend to be mostly bluster and narratives rather than reflecting actual changes on the ground. And here too, we see that social movements and indigenous movements and rural livelihood movements have felt deeply left behind by the government once now that it's in power, right? And as if they turned their backs on the people who led them to power. So there's an incredible sense of deception in the country as we speak with the current government policies. So I think that's very important to highlight. Yeah.
Absolutely. Eric, you know, since we started getting into Mexico and since you are there right now working on your dissertation, doing your fieldwork, I think it's a good time to discuss another aspect of your knowledge around Mexico, and it's based on a paper entitled Proyectos de Muerto and Proyectos de Vida, Indigenous Counter-Hegemonic Praxis to Sustainable Development in the Sierra Norte de Puebla, Mexico. You introduced this paper with an account of an elderly woman who blockades the entry of a bulldozer into the Totonaco community to commence construction of a hydropower plant in the Ajajalpa River back in 2012. I apologize if my pronunciation is not adequate. This is, of course, it's a symbol of the resistance expressed by indigenous communities, and I don't want to paint it as monolithic. I'm sure there are internal dynamics whereby it is not a unanimous resistance, but you do encounter a resistance expressed by indigenous communities in the face of this so-called sustainable development. So this hydropower, as you write, is being painted as a mode of sustainable development. And as you also write, are oftentimes state-sanctioned and corporate-driven. I'm wondering if you could talk to us a bit about these projects and how they came to be called proyectos de muerte, or projects of death, and how indigenous ontologies and ways of life, particularly of the Nahua and Totonaco, embody and are embodied by proyectos de vida, or projects of life.
Yes, I mean, I would gladly do so. Of course, this is asking to sum up my PhD research in a couple minutes. So I'll do my best, but please rein me in once I start going down the deep end and you feel like I'm getting lost in the woods, right? But just to set up
Maybe it's, I think it's important to begin by stressing that it's not just one hydropower project that was being implemented in the Sierra Norte de Puebla, nor just one mine, but that there was truly a sense of an avalanche of projects, hydropower projects and mining concessions that all occurred roughly around the same time, beginning in the early 2000s and continuing up into the second decade of the 2000s. It was more or less in 2012, late 2011, beginning of 2013, that various community organizations here in the Sierra Norte de Puebla and the population of the region started to realize that their territory was being concessioned or had been concessioned, you know, maybe a decade earlier, even without any of them having any knowledge of this. They started to realize that their rivers, there's about five major rivers running through the region, that all of them had these proposals for hydropower projects in them that mushroomed out of the blue, basically, without, again, any prior knowledge or any consultation processes. I've been able to collect, I would say, sufficient material evidence to substantiate that there were in total around a dozen hydropower projects proposed in this region, and that there have been around somewhere between 150 to 200,000 hectares concessioned off in mining concessions, in addition to another 160,000 hectares concessioned for hydrocarbon development, fracking particularly. So we're talking about huge swaths of territory being concessioned away, massive like development of the river and the exploitation of its energy potential. And this is all within a region that's roughly a 100-kilometer stretch, right, of mountains. So we're not talking about a huge area either. About 600,000 people live here, a majority of whom identify as indigenous, particularly Masewa or Nahuatl, as well as a very sizable section of people who identify as Totonaco. And indeed, they came together in resistance to these projects, kind of by force. I mean, there has been, luckily enough, a very long and rich and dense history of autonomous organizing within the region, of communities coming together to substantiate their right to self-determination and self-governance, which has led to the fact that there's a presence of community organizations dotted throughout the region. And they were able to fairly quickly articulate with one another once they started realizing, you know, this massive regional threat, that it was not just this one village confronting one hydropower project or this one village confronting one mining proposal, but that it was really like a full-blown, as they would put it, invasion of their territory, of all these different actors. And it's also maybe important to stress here that it's not just international companies, although there were US companies, Canadian companies, Chinese companies involved in this, Italian companies, but also a lot of Mexican companies behind these projects. And indeed, they were all sold as a form of sustainable development that was necessary to mitigate climate change, as well as to create economic growth in the region and provide for employment. Generally, they were sold to the population as clean, especially the hydropower projects, for not contaminating the water, for not really influencing their territorial integrity or impacting their territorial integrity, whereas the mining projects were sold much more along the classical lines of this will lead to employment and provide economic growth in your region. But when push comes to shove, they've also adapted their narratives in the last decade to reflect how they are crucial to mitigate climate change efforts, because these are minerals that are necessary for the construction of renewable energy infrastructures. Some of the mining companies were directly behind creating these hydropower projects so they could power their operations in a way that would be clean, quote unquote, and that would not contribute to climate change, greenhouse gas emissions. So this was the narrative that was being pushed very strongly by corporate and state actors. But the population fairly quickly decided upon the moniker of proyectos de muerte, projects of death, to describe this combination of projects invading their territories, not so much for the literal death they would cause, but because they see them as symptomatic of this genocidal, ecocidal trajectory that the world is on, right? Where all of the territory has to be gobbled up, and all of the communities have to be dispossessed of their lands, their rivers have to be polluted, their territories will have to be left sterile and without any possibility for the continuation of life. And that's what they see as the death, you know, that these projects bring. It's not just that when you resist these projects, some activists might get shot and receive death threats and etc., but it's the destruction left in their wake that is truly like the overarching sense of death that they point to. As one of my interviewees, I think, put it very pithily, right? There's a sense that these are that there's an intention to exterminate the population behind these projects. So that's a very strong way to put it, but that's basically trying to show how they came to this strong moniker, right? So that's on the projects of death. Let me know if you want have any questions on that before I delve into proyectos de vida, which is a whole different thing.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, and I think the speaking to the kind of violent nature of the green transition is very on point. And I think you're right that there's an intention to exterminate, and we see that kind of all around the world too, in relation to various, you know, geopolitical conflicts in Ukraine and Palestine, et cetera, et cetera. And I want to give you a chance to kind of follow up on the proyectos de vida point, Eric, and then maybe we can jump to Philippe's paper on the DRC to kind of examine this playing out in another region as well.
Sure. So if you have proyectos de vida on the other side, as the flip side of the coin of proyectos de muerte, you have to consider what the negation of these proyectos de muerte entails, right? If you're saying no to these mining developments, to these hydropower developments, which the region has done massively, there have been since 2012 assemblies that have attracted thousands and thousands of inhabitants to express their opinion about these projects and to reject these projects. The question inevitably becomes raised of, well, if you're against this, then what are you for? And here I go back to that longer history of communitarian organizing in the region. Many of the organizations involved in resisting these projects have a long pedigree of proposing alternative ways of living in the territory that are much more in harmony with nature, that are based on the cosmovisions of indigenous and Nahuatl populations and Masewa populations living here, that are much less destructive and have been proven to be sustainable for a long time, right? So here it you saw that after the initial shock and the initial necessity of having to resist the imposition of these projects, the organizations all articulated together, and the population being in such close contact through these many assemblies, started to think and reconsider this idea of, well, if we're against this, then what are we for? And to discuss the construction of life plans and the realization of proyectos de vida, which aim to not just improve the well-being and livelihoods of the population, but to do so in a way that allows for the continued flourishing of the indigenous traditions and customs, as well as the territorial integrity and ecological well-being of the region. And here I think it's really interesting to point to something called the Códice Masewal, which was a very holistic and integral plan that was published by the Union of Cooperatives Tosepan Titatanisque, which has a history of about 40 years here in the region, has nearly 40,000 cooperative members, socios, and that in 2018 began having internal reflections with the communities that form part of Tosepan to think about, well, what is it that we want for the future, right? What is this life plan that we're working towards? And they held many, many listening sessions, discussion sessions, mega assemblies. There were various rounds of reconsideration and replanting of the idea, and they all came towards considering a plan for the next 40 years of what they would like to see in the region, taking indigenous self-determination and the flourishing of their traditions and customs and identity as the central axis, basically, developing 10 strategic lines of priority to roll out and to develop, including things that might sound very familiar to folks working with indigenous and rural communities, such as indigenous respect for indigenous autonomy and self-determination, food sovereignty, energy sovereignty, financial autonomy, like all of these very crucial elements that would allow the communities to live their lives in peace, right, and not depend on these outside actors or not having to sell out their territory. So I think this is really important, and yeah, and that's what I've tried to document much more closely during my PhD research here in the region. This shift from a defensive territory in sensu stricto to a much more broad sense of the defensive territory through the construction of life plans.
Thank you for sharing that, and a super interesting kind of seeing the relationship between these two, like the two sides of the proyectos of the Muerte and the Vida, kind of like the response. Especially, it was very inspiring to hear, and I wish we could spend another hour talking about this. But since, you know, we did say we would also get into the DRC a little bit with Philippe, we'll switch gears to there right now. And Eric, I would love to follow up with you and chat more about that at some other point. But thank you so much, both of you, again. And for Philippe, I think we wanted to ask you a bit about the battery minerals supply chains and battery manufacturing project that you worked on with Raphael on cobalt extraction in the DRC. Do you think you could give us a bit of a lay of the land in regards to the situation there? Because I think a lot of our listeners, including us, are not familiar with the details as maybe we should be. And then maybe talking a little bit about the different roles of the state, private corporations, and jumping off of the kind of flip sides of resistance, the role that land defenders and activists are also playing in that situation.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, battery minerals, there's quite a few of them. You know, the number of minerals we're interested in, and in particular metals, has really risen exponentially since the late 19th century, because the technologies need more and more different types of metals with different types of properties, etc. And so cobalt is one of them. It's very useful in car batteries for the electrification of transportation through those kinds of means. And it happens that most of it is being produced in one country. So that's quite unusual. Generally for minerals, it's quite widely distributed, even more so in a way than with oil. And so the DRC has that particularity, of course, of having a really tragic history with regard to colonialism and exploitation of natural resources locally. And cobalt is, if you want, an added dimensions to this. It's often associated with copper mining. And the cobalt that is coming from the DRC is coming from that region in southeastern Congo called the Katanga in particular. And there's a very large volume of it that is being exploited. It represents about 70% of the copper that is being extracted from the around the world. Out of that, about 15 to 20% comes from artisanal mining. And artisanal mining has been kind of the main target of activists seeking to denounce the green transition in a way. Okay, so sadly, I would say artisanal miners have faced kind of a double burden. The first thing is, well, there are industrial mines around, and so that pollutes the air, that pollutes the soil. It takes over land. Redistribution is not always great, though the region has relatively good services compared to many others. So one should not paint, you know, too much of a somber picture. But nonetheless, they've been the victims of exploitation. Yet there's a tiny little silver lining in this, is that artisanal miners are, you know, able to, you know, partake a little bit into this exploitation. And critics of the green transitions, what they have done in a way is lead a lot of the corporations to decide on excluding, controlling, formalizing artisanal miners. And so it starts from maybe a relatively good intention in principle. In practice, it has mostly been a tool of protecting their reputation, especially when faced by reports such as the, Amnesty International and those types of reports denouncing child labor that has been associated with artisanal mining much more than is industrial mining. So the result of that, as well as in many other cases, is that efforts to formalize a mining sector that includes a lot of artisanal miners has led to the further marginalization. And there's often high cost associated with formalizing oneself, and that takes a that can take a toll. So I don't know how we can push it a little bit, but the distinctions made between artisanal and artisanal and mining and industrial mining is very is often put in very stark terms. While in fact, those industries, those subsectors, if you want, commingle much more frequently, in part because the industry, the industrial scale companies, often are looking for deposits through the activities of artisanal mining. That's a little bit how it started in the region. And on the flip side, artisanal miners, well, sometimes they work formally, sometimes they work informally. They've got many types of relationship with this industry. Okay. So the reputational risk that those companies face has led them to take different strategies. Some have decided to exit, they are relatively rare. Others have decided to engage and partner, if you want, with organizations that specialize in these formalization attempts in partnership with the state. Okay. And so there's been like different types of things done, such as ban certifications based on standards of extractions, etc. There's been a lot of audits being conducted, and there's been like technology-based tracking that is now being kind of deployed out there through notably blockchain technology. There's also been technical support for miners and mining community development, and with some alternative livelihoods, stuff, etc. So all this, if you want, has led to a very complex picture whereby artisanal miners have thought ways to reintegrate the market by the sidelines, often taking more risk than they would otherwise. And that's where, in part, a lot of the violence can take place. Okay. In part because the industry wants to keep the artisanal miners out in sometimes very brutal ways, because if they are seen to be operating within the concession, well, that can tarnish their reputation. The miners have had to look at more marginal areas, and in doing so, they have to dig like shallow pits where falls can happen, collapse of tunnels can happen, etc., etc. So there's a lot of, if you want, side effects of these strategies. At the same time, when they're well conducted, in principle, they should deliver a little bit of improvement. But there's many critics out there. The first one I would say is probably that, and we mentioned that in the paper, is really an over-reliance on Western service providers and aid agencies, etc. And so there's very little buying, relatively little or tokenistic, consultation, etc. And as a result, very often local ownership is not there, and that translates into kind of a lot of skepticism on these schemes. The schemes are seen as ticking exercising, as putting constraints, not really there to defend the rights and aspirations of artisanal miners, but much more to protect the companies. Okay.
And Philippe, just quickly, I'm wondering, who are these companies? I mean, are they associated with Western nations, with China?
They're a mix of both. And very often, when I say a mix, it's actually they've got joint ventures as well. So, okay. So you traditionally had Belgium companies. It was a Belgium colony. Then you had a national company with still a strong relationship with Belgium, and then slowly it evolved. And then you saw major companies, especially commodity trading companies, taking stakes in this, as well as the emergence of Chinese mining companies. When you're dealing with the informal trading and exporting, then you're dealing mostly with Chinese exporters because that's where the cobalt is going. Okay, and they are the ones that are operating at the interstices between industrial mining and artisanal. You know, buying a little bit on both sides sometimes.
Yeah, this does seem like a lot of complicated dynamics, especially what we were talking about prior with like China's rise as a global power and the resource dimensions of that, kind of the dynamics between all the companies there. But thanks for explaining and like giving us that mapping. Do you have any ideas on potentially how to make the process less violent? I know that's a big question, but as we're talking about like the different points of violence in there.
Yeah, I mean, violence takes many, many forms in those places. So the one we can immediately think about is, you know, police repression, those types of violence, and where, you know, designating mining areas for artisanal miners can help. So that has been done in some ways, but they may not be the best ones, or you know, there are different constraints associated with it. Another one, of course, has been, you know, like the fact that formalization requirements and certification requirements sometimes constrain the ability of miners to get the best prices because they have to operate on the sidelines. And that has, you know, results in terms of some forms of economic violence in a way. You know, they don't get as good prices, they work harder, they work longer, and they don't bring as much money back, they don't feed their kids or can pay for tuition fees, etc. So very, very practical. And the third level, of course, is at the environmental level, what people breathe, what do they, you know, with the dust that they ingest, etc. And at that level, it's mostly about the, you know, environmental regulations that are put in place there. And the fact that mining has become so important, both for the industrial and the artisanal, that it takes place in locations that clearly expose local populations to you know, to toxic elements.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, we know that we need cobalt in order to develop batteries, right? And I think, do you think that these sorts, like the framing of these regions as sacrifice zones or extraction sites or places where violence might be inherent, is something that's just implicitly baked into when we talk about sustainable development? Or do you think there's like a potential other way forward?
Yes, and it is quite complicated. So in a way, it is portrayed as a sacrifice zone, but the discourse associated with it is we're going to try to make it the best possible, so the least sacrificial, and you know that the intensity of the sacrifice goes low. And the way to do that is often say, well, industry does it in a cleaner way, you know, like the industrial scale mining, which is not always true. Another one is to say, well, we're going to help formalize and educate and provide technical support and audit the artisan miners, so you know their lives are not sacrificed. And then there is another layer that comes in, which is that precisely because this is seen as a sacrifice zone, there are other areas of the world that are now being portrayed as places without sacrifices. And here we go into the deep sea mining, for example, which has really tried to harness this thing. When you look at the discourses of the companies, they say no tree will be cut. No child will be employed, and etc. So, you know, it's of course a rhetoric that does not or tries to invisibilize the extractive arm that can be done on sea bottoms. So, of course, they are not comparable, but it's precisely by making these distinctions that they can, you know, and leveraging in a way, weaponizing also to use this, you know, quite fashionable term, the idea that too much sacrifice is being made in the DRC. Why don't we shift the whole thing to the bottom of the ocean? But in doing so, of course, this is doubly sacrificing those communities because, first, well, they're going to live with the legacies of these pollutions. And now they're going to have to face, for example, if this is pursued, a collapse of the industry that will devastate them further. Okay, so this is not a road to be taken. And that's no surprise that the African group has generally been very reluctant or have been in opposition to deep sea mining because they see the writing on the wall.
As in, it's going to basically leave a wasteland and take away economic activity that that has been there for a while, right?
We've seen that in the Niger Delta in part. Many of the coastal areas that were being exploited by large companies, they moved offshore in order to distance themselves from the harm that has been caused and the potential new harms that would be associated with continued activities. It doesn't mean that the pollution has gone away. It doesn't mean that new actors have not entered. And so as a result, the situation has not very much improved.
Mm-hmm. I find the justification discourse is always very interesting in the sense that when you want to move into a territory, you justify it by saying you will create economic activity, but then when it's very harmful, it creates this idea of an incentive that we are now going to relocate somewhere where we've created essentially the sacrifice zone. It's time to mm-hmm. move away from that.
Unsacrifice it.
Other sacrifices.
Mm-hmm.
I would have loved to discuss this further, but sadly we are running out of time. So I would like to ask you both my final question.
Okay, to wrap up, while your work is full of critical engagement, it is also full of hope and constructive thinking. When speaking of social movements and international initiatives, you write, quote, "A more genuine geopolitics that departs from the fundamental premise of caring for the long-term health and well-being of both people and planet must thus simultaneously dismantle imperial structures of socio-ecological domination and destruction, as well as construct altered geopolitical arrangements of power and liberation that facilitate human flourishing and peaceful coexistence based on regenerative modes of living. Although this might seem like asking for utopian earth politics, it is the most realistic pathway for transforming the ecocidal, genocidal trajectory of the geopolitical metabolism in the Green War era," end quote. So I'd like to conclude by asking you both, what is it that allows you to channel your critical engagements into this constructive and hopeful spirit? Eric?
So for me, I would say that it's been the experience of being here in the Sierra Norte de Puebla and seeing firsthand how communities, when organized and articulated in struggle with other communities and organizations and allies and accompanying powers, are able to resist this extractive imperative and this invasion of these projects. Here in the region, they've basically succeeded in halting all of the projects from being implemented and from establishing themselves, including through such historic achievements as having one of the first Supreme Court decisions at the national level recognizing indigenous sovereignty and indigenous rights and indigenous self-determination over the mining concessions that were granted in territories here in the Sierra Norte de Puebla, and the violation of their rights through the granting of these concessions, which never happened before in any Mexican court. So that's really impressive, right? And not only are they able to halt the imposition of these extremely violent neocolonial forms of domination, but they are able to articulate these regenerative modes of living, not just alone, but together in alliance with other community organizations and communities here in the region, where it's an incredibly hopeful prospect to see how, in the face of such adversity and difficult circumstances, including right now being compounded through the very dire impacts of climate change being felt throughout the region, communities are able to continue struggling towards establishing these regenerative modes of living and are able to reconnect with their heritage, their identity, their territory, and keep struggling onwards to fight for a better way of life, for respect for their rights, and for the flourishing of their communities, right? They're not in it for themselves, all the activists who I speak to. The overarching motivation for all of them is to be able to grant to their children and grandchildren that immense privilege of living in a healthy environment, in relative peace and calm, with autonomy over how you live your life and with decision-making power over what occurs in your territory. And I think that's incredibly motivating and inspirational to see firsthand. And it's incredibly important to take that message and apply it elsewhere, not just in indigenous communities in the Sierra Norte de Puebla, but to think about how such geopolitics of hope and regeneration also apply at, let's say, the European level or the Canadian level or the BC level, right? And yeah, for me, it's been one very long road of immense pleasure to work with communities here in the region and to see these processes firsthand. And I just want to plug something quickly, because I think it's important for those who are interested in learning more about this. We just published a dense research report with Poder, a Mexican research NGO, on the extractive projects in the region, as well as four histories of the defense of territory in the Sierra Norte de Puebla that are great to explore by themselves, but also translated into a website, an interactive website that people can visit to have an interactive map, the investigation, as well as a network analysis of the ownership, corporate ownership, and the corporate structure of all of these projects to really delve into the details. Unfortunately, those are only available in Spanish at the moment, but we're hoping to translate them to English very soon. And if folks have questions about those, I would say please get into contact with me, and perhaps we can put the link to the website and the report in the field notes for the podcast.
Yes, we absolutely will. Thank you, Eric, so much. And thank you for sharing that. I'm going to check out these resources for sure. Philippe, would you like to share what gives you hope?
What gives me hope? Not much, because I'm much older. But people on the ground, you know, communities on the ground, like Eric is saying, but also social movements. Okay, it's true that at the large scale, we're thinking, oh yes, there was that youth climate movement, you know, and kind of it continues, it peters out sometimes, but you know, that gives me a little bit of a hope. What also gives me hope is there's a deep sense that we need to have a restorative type of political system with regard to the earth, that the new generation, although full of contradictions, understand that you know, a lot of damage was done in the past and this needs to be repaired. So a kind of geopolitics of repair, of regeneration, is really, really important. Now, how can that translate into like broad politics is a major issue, because all the anxiety, all the fears that are associated with this state can fuel, you know, political parties that are not very much progressive on these fronts. It's kind of a retreating back. So what gives me hope is, you know, all the new political movements that are trying to escape that. And very often what we see on the ground is a kind of altered geopolitics where people retrench to the communities, retrench. And it has some advantages, meaning you can implement it, but it needs a lot more coalition between these groups in order to have a more global effect. Otherwise, what we will see is more a kind of restoration of the old orders that will include the fossil fuel orders, etc., you know, with some pushback. So I have a little bit of hope, but I think the solidarity element is very, very important, and the diffusion of these ideas and practical policies. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So very much this the Gramsci saying, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will, right?
Correct.
Okay. Well, thank you both so much for giving us your time and your thoughts and your insights. This has been wonderful. I'm really sorry for the time, both for not having enough time and for going a bit over time. But again, I really appreciate your presence. Erica, would you like to say something?
No, just thank you so much. I feel like I learned so much in the last hour. My brain is like buzzing and very excited for the show notes and to just continue the conversation in whatever ways possible.
Thank you both.
Thank you tremendously, Yusuf and Erica. It's been fabulous to be part of the podcast and to be able to share some of our research. And thank you for the incisive questions. Really looking forward to seeing where you take the podcast.